The cost of cake in courtrooms. The cost of cake in courtrooms. Back in Red Hill, Ben and Sarah were preparing to close a chapter of their lives. One last adventure awaited them elsewhere. They had poured their hearts into the cafe, built something meaningful, but the time had come to move on. Enter Hannah O'Brien, confident, polished, and glowing with the kind of purposeful energy you often find in people who've just changed course in life. She came from the corporate world, where spreadsheets reigned and days were carved into endless meetings. But that world had grown hollow for her. With a 3-year-old daughter in tow and a husband still neck-deep in finance but wholly supportive, Hannah had made a decision. She would reclaim her time, her joy, and maybe even a version of herself she'd left behind in her student years, when she pulled pints and waited tables, and life had the rough-edged charm of hospitality. When she saw the Red Hill Cafe up for sale, she leapt at it. The price was right. The story was romantic. She'd read the glowing write-ups in the local paper, the wedding celebrations held on the grounds, the community vibe, the warmth. She wanted some of that. She wanted all of it. She did the deal with Ben, shook hands with me across a worn wooden table. I liked her straight away, down to earth, full of intent, with a daughter who charmed everyone who walked through the door. We went over the franchise agreement, the council lease, the obligations. She listened intently, ticking things off in her head, confident in her ability to juggle figures and fix problems. Ben trained her personally in the weeks before the handover, walking her through the rhythms and rituals of running the cafe. When Ben and Sarah finally left, it was bittersweet. If your heart's calling from somewhere else, you've got to follow it. Otherwise, you wither. They left the place in good hands. At first, Hannah thrived. She was a natural in the kitchen, baking pastries, introducing homemade cakes, trying out new sandwich specials. She had flair. But it wasn't long before the honeymoon faded, and the weight of the work began to settle heavily across her shoulders. Running a cafe, she discovered, wasn't about the odd hour here and there. It was endless. Opening early, scrubbing counters long after closing, mopping the floor with aching feet, restocking toilet paper and soap, dashing to the cash and carry in the dark, half-empty boot rattling with supplies. She hadn't imagined this. She hadn't imagined delivery drivers demanding cash while lunch orders flew out the door, or staff calling in sick, or being pulled away from bedtime stories to field supplier calls. Her mother stepped in, took her granddaughter to nursery, to music classes, things Hannah had planned to do herself. Her heart ached as she watched time with her daughter shrink like a puddle in the sun. Being an accountant by trade, Hannah tried to fix it the only way she knew how, logically. She increased her part-time staff's hours, handed off responsibility for opening and closing, brought in extra help for the lunch rush. In theory, it was perfect. In practice, it was flawed. Customer service, as she learned the hard way, doesn't always survive delegation. Staff who didn't have their own skin in the game didn't carry the same care. Corners were cut, cleaning slipped, orders came out late or wrong, and customers, always the first to notice, began drifting away. The numbers didn't lie. Her spreadsheets were telling a grim story. Wages, rent, utilities, and management fees to us were eating into what little profit was left. Her return was barely measurable. We met often. I tried to help, funneled corporate catering leads her way, contracts for office lunches, conferences, events that ranged from intimate meetings to 100 guest spreads. But she couldn't trust the team to execute. The confidence wasn't there, the heart wasn't in it. Not from them, and increasingly not from her either. Within a year and a half, she and her husband made the call. There were only 2 years left on the lease. And with the cafe's resale value near rock bottom, most of the catering kit belonged to the council, there was little to gain by hanging on. She cried when she told me, not just from disappointment, but from relief. The time with her daughter, that was what mattered most. The cafe had been a dream, but it was time to wake up. Reluctantly, but with quiet resolution, Hannah jacked it in. And just like that, the shutters came down on another era. The Red Hill Cafe, once a beacon of community warmth and a showcase for our brand, was now fast becoming a nemesis. For years, that dubious title belonged to Frimley Lodge, but Red Hill was unraveling fast. We had already removed one franchisee from Frimley Lodge, dismissed for breaching our brand values, serious allegations of inappropriate behavior toward a staff member. And then came Sharn. Sharn was caught red-handed during a council-led mystery shop operation. Three golfers had paid, but only one appeared in the till. Five golfers had paid, only one appeared in the till. When confronted, Sharn immediately blamed his staff, but the report showed otherwise, an Asian man performing the transactions too. Sharn was the only Asian man working there. There was no ambiguity, no way out. He was finished. Worse, when we interviewed staff, a pattern of deceit emerged. They revealed that Sharn had instructed them to manipulate the till. Ice creams were to be rung through as takeaway cheese sandwiches, same price but tax exempt, while cash was quietly slipped into the drawer. It was a full-scale operation. Not sloppy theft. This was calculated fraud. 2 years later, something more alarming, his sister, running a cafe in Palawal, appeared to be pulling the exact same tricks. We dispatched one of our trusted mystery shoppers to investigate. The findings were eerily familiar, almost textbook. The report said the exterior of the Palawal Cafe was clean enough, save for a cracked window. The toilets, superficially maintained, had toilet paper scattered across the floor, just enough to betray neglect. On entering the cafe, the shopper wasn't greeted. The only staff member on duty, later identified as Ranjit, was tucked away in the kitchen. Whenever the cafe emptied of customers, she'd vanished to the back. There was no active front-of-house presence. Everything, coffee, tea, sandwiches, was served in paper takeaway cups and polystyrene plates. No crockery, no cutlery, no washing up, but bins were overflowing. By 11 a.m., the waste bin by the door was full, and by the time the shopper left at 12:40 p.m., it remained untouched. And then came the real issue, the transactions. The mystery shopper took a seat at the first table on the right, chosen specifically for a clear view of the counter. Over the next 2 hours, they meticulously observed and documented every transaction, more than 24 in total. Not once did they see a till entry. Every card payment was processed directly on the card reader. Every cash transaction saw money go straight into the drawer, with the till manually opened. No keystrokes, no receipts, no digital records. Listed every item sold between 10:22 a.m. and 12:35 p.m. from Lucozade to lattes, bacon sandwiches to calipos. The cafe was busy, but on paper, it was barely trading. The shopper even noted their final purchase at 12:33 p.m., a single shortbread. When they tapped to pay, the server asked if they wanted to add anything more to avoid a card charge. A seemingly innocent question. But combined with the till avoidance, it told a much deeper story. They managed to discreetly capture video footage, not clear enough to show the absence of till entries directly, but damning enough to prove that no one had the time, space, or intention to record anything properly. Once again, a cafe in our network was committing fraud under the same tactics Sharn had pioneered, and it wasn't him this time. It was his sister. A pattern of deceit seemed to run in the family. The same disregard for our systems, the same manipulation of sales, the same smug confidence they wouldn't be caught. Back in Red Hill, we weren't facing criminal deceit, thankfully, but we were facing something almost as disruptive, mismanagement. Red Hill had no leadership, no anchor. And in the midst of all this, I was wading through the wreckage of a court case. Sharn, one of our former franchisees, removed for stealing council golf course revenue, was suing us for wrongful dismissal, misrepresentation, and just about every petty grievance his solicitor could fabricate. My weekly relief came in the form of Thursday evenings at the Talbot in Lewisham, Fred's local. There, over pints and pizza, I'd meet with Fred and a few regulars. Fred had recently separated from Ruth. They still ran their cafe, but alternated days. She had moved into a nearby rental while he stayed in the family home with their kids, Hannah, Francis, and Bob. Every Thursday was quiz night, and we'd also invented our own Premier League prediction game. Fixtures were written down, and each of us would fill in our predicted outcomes, home win, away win, or draw. We each chipped in £2. The pot went to the winner, but typically, they'd use it to buy a round or cover the pizza. Simple pleasures, real camaraderie. One of the crew was Dan French, a thoughtful, kind-hearted man from the Midlands, former amateur punk musician. Previously employed in supported housing, but the position was unfortunately dissolved following significant funding cutbacks. He was in the middle of a painful divorce and temporarily homeless. Fred, now needing a place of his own after Ruth decided to move back into the family home, agreed to house share with Dan. Around that same time, Hannah stepped away from running the Red Hill Cafe. The timing was uncanny. One Thursday evening, beer in hand, the conversation turned to the cafe. Dan was at a loose end. I looked at him. "Would you be interested in running Red Hill for me?" To my surprise, he said yes. After all the misfires, court drama, and franchisee betrayal, it felt like the break we needed. A new face, a clean slate, a man with integrity. Red Hill was getting another chance. Dan French was beaming when I offered him Red Hill. After everything he'd been through, divorce, the eviction, the emotional spiral, it felt like hope had finally found its way back to him. He was glowing with appreciation, clutching the opportunity like a man who hadn't had a break in years. He brought his brother Nick with him, down from Nottingham for a few weeks, and the two of them threw themselves into the work. I trained them together, shoulder to shoulder, showing them the systems, the suppliers, the reconciliation sheets, the rhythm of a day behind the counter. For a moment, it looked like Red Hill might finally breathe again. But Dan came with baggage. And this time, it wasn't metaphorical. He had three children he absolutely doted on. The youngest, Noah, was delicate and wide-eyed, the kind of child you instinctively wanted to protect. He went to a Steiner school, not the one in nearby Blackheath, but all the way in North London. And Dan, in his commitment to co-parenting, had agreed to share custody evenly. That meant morning school runs, long grinding commutes across the city, before he could even begin his journey down to Red Hill. More often than not, he arrived after 10 a.m., flustered and apologetic, sometimes later. You can't run a cafe like that. Not one that relies on prep-heavy catering, early starts, and fresh morning trade. You need time to bake off pastries, cook bacon, prep the cake counter, fill the gastronomes before the lunch rush. If you miss that rhythm, you miss the heartbeat of the day, and Dan was missing it, again and again. I started to see the cracks form quickly, and just as Red Hill was slipping out of focus, another opportunity began to take shape. A forgotten little kiosk in Red Lion Square, Holborn. Camden Council had put out a call for expressions of interest. Most overlooked it. I didn't. I pitched. I won. The timing was uncanny. The kiosk was far more central, close to Noah's school even, and it felt like a second chance. I started thinking, maybe this was Dan's spot. A place better suited to his life, his rhythms, his obligations. And while all of this was happening, in an entirely different corner of the world, a man named Ender Turkilmaz was viewing my Bedford Cafe listing, a cafe I had submitted a tender for, on a small screen from his location in Thailand. Ender was Turkish by blood, but had spent years navigating the back streets and islands of Southeast Asia. He used to work for a Danish tourism company, negotiating bulk hotel deals, managing bookings, greasing the wheels of international travel. But when a Danish cartoonist mocked the Prophet Muhammad, political chaos followed. Thailand cut its ties with Denmark overnight, and Ender's job vanished. He didn't crumble. He adapted. He stayed in Thailand, married a sharp Russian woman named Svetlana, and together they built a life, a family, a business. She sold American baseball caps and pop culture gear from kiosks and hotel lobbies. He managed a boutique island hotel and opened two kebab shawarma stalls in busy shopping malls. Their life was full, but Ender had his eyes on something bigger, something British. They wanted to raise their children in the UK. They wanted the structure, the education, the promise. So Ender reached out. At first, I dismissed him as just another dreamer clicking through businessesforsale.com, but I sent the franchise prospectus anyway. Months passed. I forgot about him. Then, out of the blue, he was here. He'd landed in Enfield and was ready to buy into the franchise. The Bedford site had fallen through, but Claygate was on the horizon. We'd just won the tender to run a brand new cafe beside the wreck, thanks to Helen Maguire, a woman with roots in Lewisham and a fondness for pistachios in the park. The only catch? The cafe hadn't been built yet. Construction would take time. £1 million build, minimum. It was a waiting game. Ender had already sold his hotel share and had money in the bank. Svetlana was wrapping up the businesses back home. So I made him a proposition. Run Red Hill in the interim. We'd draw up a letter confirming the future Claygate franchise, enough to satisfy the home office, and he'd pay a nominal deposit. It was a win-win. He got his visa process rolling. We got Red Hill back on its feet. Ender dove in headfirst. He loved the cafe, learned everything fast, managed mostly on his own with the help of Peppercorn staff, booked into the Premier Inn. He had just started house hunting in preparation for his family's arrival. It was through that search that we stumbled upon Buckland Estates and its eccentric, aristocratic landlord, Dominic Sanders. Dominic's lineage was etched into the very soil. His family had owned half the parish for over 300 years. Farms, cottages, mineral rights, their legacy was embedded in deeds and boundary stones. But Dominic was chasing a new legacy. He'd carved a beach into the edge of a disused quarry lake and now dreamed of a cafe overlooking the water. A destination, a gathering place. He had the land, the backdrop, and the ambition. What he didn't have was a business model. That's where I came in. He turned to me and I took his raw vision and shaped it into something real. I drafted the entire concept, operations, customer experience, community impact, down to the smallest detail. I built the business plan from the ground up, a blueprint rooted in both commercial viability and creative vision. He steered it through the council's approval process, navigating every objection and revision, and secured planning consent. Construction began. A dream was starting to rise from the quarry dust, and it all began with that plan. I was juggling all this, Red Hill, Claygate, Buckland, Ender, when the Red Lion Square project came back to the fore. I brought it to Fred. Could we, the three of us, Fred, Dan, and I, make it work? Fred was rotating three-month stints with Ruth at Hillyfields now, so he had capacity. Dan was out of work again. And this kiosk? Right near Noah's school. We saw an opportunity. We needed funding, urgently, not just to bring the cafe to life, but to protect its independence. We wanted to keep the project out of the hands of Pistachios in the Park, to ensure it had its own identity, its own soul. So we applied for a loan through Funding Circle. However, as a newly formed business with no trading history or equity to stand on, we couldn't secure funding on our own merit. We had to lean on Pistachios in the Park Lidded to act as the official guarantor. But the lender required more than just a company name. They wanted individuals to stand behind the promise. And so the financial burden fell squarely on Pistachios in the Park Lidded, with Diane and me stepping up as personal guarantors. We weren't just backing the business. We were putting ourselves on the line, accepting full responsibility if things went wrong. It was a calculated risk, one we took knowingly, driven by belief in what we were building. Fred and Opal signed as witnesses, a quiet but pivotal moment that bound us all to the venture. When the funds landed, £20,000, it felt like the green light we had been waiting for. We moved quickly. Every pound was put to work. Fixtures were ordered, laborers contracted, council rent paid, equipment installed. Slowly, the empty shell of a kiosk began to transform into something real, something we had envisioned. We launched with excitement and pride, watching customers arrive and the cafe come to life. But behind the scenes, the foundations were already starting to shift. Tensions rose. Fred and I were butting heads, our visions clashing, communication fraying. The project had momentum, but the cracks beneath it had begun to show. My timekeeping, never my strongest suit, had begun to strain more than just the schedule. Missed mornings turned into slipped deadlines, and with each lapse, I could feel the tension thickening. It wasn't just irritation. It was something heavier, layered with the weight of our long friendship. Fred and I had history, years of shared work, trust, and loyalty, but now that foundation felt shaky. I could sense the unspoken frustration building between us, and I knew I couldn't let it silently corrode what we had. So I confronted it, acknowledged my part, said what needed to be said. But the cracks weren't just personal. Financial pressure was closing in fast. The rent alone, £17,500 a year, was a burden we hadn't yet found the strength to carry. The business hadn't found its rhythm, and we were already stretched thin. The exhaustion hit early. We were burning out before we even had a chance to build momentum. Not long after the launch, reality set in. It wasn't working. And so with heavy hearts and quieter conversations, we made the decision to pull the plug. But the weight of the loan still pressed heavily on us. £600 every month clawing at our finances, and the full £20,000 already burned through. Then, just when hope seemed distant, Salvation arrived like clockwork. Nelson Gate appeared, check in hand, eyes gleaming with conviction. He believed in the dream, embraced the concept, and without hesitation paid the full £20,000 up front, covering the franchise fee along with setup and fixtures costs. It should have been our clean escape, the moment to flip the deal and walk away free. But we didn't, because lurking in the background was Sharn's looming legal battle, a storm gathering strength. The court date was set, October. High Court, Holborn. Our solicitor and barrister laid down the law. No representation without full payment up front. £20,000. The cost of justice. The price of survival. And Nelson's payment had just landed. Diane and I were in Cyprus when the email came through. Adrian joined us on the call. We weighed the options. Pay back the loan or fight for survival. We chose the latter. The loan was manageable. The court battle was not. We bet everything on the belief that we could weather another storm. The decision was made. We would fight. The barrister was paid, our arguments prepared, and the court date, October, High Court, Holborn, circled in bold red ink. Everything else faded into the background. This was now about principle. As we geared up for court, the tension was suffocating. It wasn't just about showing up and presenting a defense. It was about surviving the lead-up. The sleepless nights, the anxious legal calls, the financial balancing act we were performing to stay afloat. Adrian was stoic, practical. Diane, furious, uncompromising. Me? I was caught somewhere between anger and disbelief, because I had been here before. Years earlier, I had faced a case with the Inland Revenue. It had been dismissed, but the memory lingered. I couldn't believe I was back in a courtroom. This time, everything was on the line. When the day arrived, Holborn felt theatrical. The High Court loomed like a monument to finality. We entered not as entrepreneurs, but as defendants. Sharn, dressed in a cheap suit and armed with a performative expression of victimhood, arrived with his legal team. Confident, smug, betting on pressure and optics. Court began. The judge addressed the room, noting concern that the case had even reached the High Court. He questioned the logic of hearing it in two phases. First, whether the bank was acting as an agent of Pistachio's, and second, the claim of misrepresentation. He proposed hearing both together to save costs and time. No one objected. The focus began with the nature of the bank's role. Sharn had submitted a franchise business plan template to the bank as is, without tailoring it to his own business. His legal team argued the bank acted on behalf of Pistachio's and that the plan was flawed. We countered, the bank was an independent entity. Sharn had been instructed to adapt the plan, we had supplied the figures. In fact, the bank required those documents for the £40,000 loan to be approved. Next came the misrepresentation claim. They said we fabricated figures. We argued the projections were based on models created by Clive Sawyer, our franchise broker, using historic growth assumptions, not actuals, and clearly labeled as such. We never misled anyone. Yes, I had been trading in Manor House Gardens since 2000, but the Pistachio's model only formally began in 2008. This distinction mattered. There were even questions about where we first met Sharn and his brother. We had stated it was an eatery on the A3. They claimed it was a service station on the M1. Truthfully, years later, I recall both meetings occurred, but the sequence is blurred. Still, we maintained our original story. Then came the moment of vindication. The judge was clear. There was no evidence of wrongful dismissal, no compelling proof of misrepresentation. This case, he said, should not have come to court. We had won, it was over, or so we thought. Outside, Diane lit a cigarette, exhaling as though it was her first real breath in weeks. I told you, she said, coldly. Drippings of my arse. We laughed, not from joy but from sheer relief. We'd survived. We'd stood firm, but our barrister pulled us aside. They'd filed for an appeal. They're clutching at straws, he said. The appeal won't be granted, and if it is, I'll appeal that on the grounds of stalling, because right now they're liable for all legal costs. I reminded him that costs were meaningless in our situation. Sharn had no assets, no funds. Even if we won again, we'd see nothing. It was a win-win for him, a win-lose for us. Still, I wanted to celebrate. This was our victory, however brief. I wanted to thank those who had stood by us. Our franchisees, our partners, who had stayed loyal and even submitted supporting statements. One from Hannah O'Brien stood out. I took over an established PITP business in Red Hill. Although I bought it from a private seller, ASIN was involved and very open about the risks and rewards. The franchise agreement was clear. ASIN went above and beyond. I have enjoyed working with him. Elizabeth Cooper, another longtime supporter, wrote, I've known ASIN for 26 years. He gave me my first job. After his wife passed, I watched him rebuild. I agreed to become his first franchisee. He helped me get loans, explained the figures, was honest from the start. 8 years later, my cafe is going strong. ASIN is one of the most honest, family-valuing men I know. And Fred Harding, our friend and franchisee, wrote, I've known ASIN for over 25 years. I was best man at his wedding. After his wife's death, he rebuilt his life. I helped build out several cafes. I joined Pistachios, and together we built something great. Our turnover exceeded projections. Joining the franchise was one of the best decisions of my life. None of this was brought up by our legal team in court. Maybe it didn't fit the legal argument, but for us, it mattered. It validated who we were and what we stood for. Yes, they'd appealed. Yes, we might have to go back to court. But for now, we'd won. We were bruised, but not broken. And for the first time in a long time, I felt a glimmer of pride again. We had faced the storm, and we were still standing.